Good evening and welcome to the third session of Moi. We have a very delightful, fun, engaging, intrepid little selections for you tonight. So hang on, everybody. Here we go. We don't know the date. We don't do time, but it's Moi Trez. Here we go. Hang on.
Economy, yet it actually is on the secret economy. It was just something which has to be treated now because we're about to go into a crisis one way or the other, in which either in a fairly short term the whole world goes to hell, and I do mean goes to hell, or we win. And if we win, which I'll discuss here summarily, then we have to face some new kinds of challenges which we have not faced before in modern history, even ancient history as well. What we are faced with is the prospect, which is now a jammed up works, which has no clear predictability, that is, no mechanical predictability can be assigned to the current developments of this present week. These are momentous developments, one way or the other. Either the Glass-Steagall provision gets through the Senate, probably this week, in which case we enter into the prospect of a new world financial economic system. Or we don't, which means we have a couple of short options in the following period whereby we might survive. I'm talking about nations survive, civilization surviving. Because if we cannot get a reform in which wipes out quadrillions of nominal dollars of worthless assets, financial assets, then there's no chance to save civilization planet-wide from a new dark age. I've gone through this before, but that's where we are. We're right there now, this week, this present week, and whatever ensues immediately out of that to either capitalize on a victory or to, it's a qualified victory, of course, or to face a plunge into hell. And that's where everybody is. This is not where some people are. This is where everybody on the planet is right now. The fact that some people protest they don't believe that only exposes the fact that they're ignorant of reality. If they're in the world of reality, they know that. But there are a limited number of people who have any glimmering of reality at all. And you have also a great number of people who should be able to understand reality, but don't wish to. Typical of the boomers, for example. When they don't wish to accept reality, they deny it. And they say that anybody else who's saying something different than what they wish to believe is something wrong with them, psychologically or whatnot. So that's where we stand. Now let's look at the optimistic side. Presume that we win something in the course of this week, which amounts to the security of the launching of a new Glass-Steagall reform. Now, the essential thing, this has to start in the United States. And sometimes you accept a limited prospect of reform because it's better to get the stepping stone to later improvements than it is to gamble everything on an exaggerated goal. What we should limit ourselves to is the idea of putting the Glass-Steagall reform into place immediately for the United States. Now, what follows? In that case, we go through the reform, which is rather the elementary side of what we have to do. It doesn't require that much explanation for us people who are smarter than some other people. But the next step is we have to save Europe. And we can't save all of Europe because they don't wish to be saved. But we take a case like a country like Germany. We have in Germany a leading potential for really a significant turnaround. It would be a rather shocking and rapid one in the main. We have, if that occurs, you also have a possibility of something good coming out of France. And you will have something interesting coming out of northern Italy. More significant on the condition that these developments occur is that Russia will then be in a position to dump its present ties to this fake thing, the Inter Alpha Group, otherwise called the BRIC, and will come into a four-power global agreement with the United States and with China and India and other countries, which will establish a new world system based on the Glass-Steagall principle of management of banks and similar kinds of things. That will put the thing under control. It will wipe out quadrillions of dollars denomination of filthy lucre, which was always gambling money or papier-mâché money or monopoly game money, and never really money, not in an honest way. But then we have to face the physical rebuilding process and organizing it, which again means we're going to a large-scale infrastructure program, which is going to be the driver for rebuilding agriculture and industry. So the credit will go first primarily toward the infrastructure programs, the major ones. And as a part, as an offshoot of the major infrastructure programs, you'll have contracts going out to manufacturers, et cetera, who will then be getting federal credit for them to crank up to meet their requirements for servicing the infrastructure projects, which they're helping to build up by their work. So we get to that point. Now, that means we now settle down to establishing a worldwide fixed exchange rate system and a new form of what Roosevelt had intended had he lived, Franklin Roosevelt, had he lived. But it's going to be a long haul of about two generations, first of all, to launch major and conduct major infrastructure projects, which will drive the world, and to build up the industries and agriculture that goes with that, and to take a population which is largely unqualified for employment in any productive sector, which is pretty much worldwide as a result of the past 40 years' developments. And we're going to have to gradually build this labor force up till it's a functional labor force, in the same sense that Franklin Roosevelt, over the course of the 1930s and into the period of World War II, actually transformed a broken-down system, a broken-down labor force and industry, into the mightiest force the world had ever seen in economics. We're going to have to start from a much lower point than we did when we came out of 1932-33. Back then in the United States and also in Europe. So this is where we stand. Now, in this process, in doing this, we're going to have to make some radical changes in the nature of the way we conceive of an organized economy. We will still use money, of course, money as part of a credit system, a fixed exchange rate credit system based on a regulated commercial banking system of the Glass-Steagall model. That we're going to do. But otherwise, in planning what we're going to do with the economy, the physical economy, we've got a couple of rethinking jobs to do. First of all, we will just simply do the obvious, but we don't have much of a labor force for what we have to do. So that gives you this long-term perspective. Now, what we're going to have to do is look at, for the first time in the history of mankind, we're going to have to worldwide look at what we call a physical economy, that's my department, in a way which has never been understood before. To me, I understand it. I've been living with it long enough, I should be able to understand it. I've been working with this much longer than most of you guys have lived. total life, lifespan. So I have some familiarity with this. Now, this means we're going to go into what I call in this article, which is coming out of the line, called Secret Economy. Most of you are sufficiently, at least on this line, are sufficiently informed on some matters that we can discuss it rather simply. Physical economy means that we are looking at the increase of the physical productive powers of labor per capita and per square kilometer of land area. This means that we are not only progressing technologically at rates per capita and per square kilometer, which more than overcome the depletion of potential which we've lost over the recent decades. Now we say generations, practically three generations. But then we have to also go beyond that. And with the population now approaching the levels we're now reaching, about towards 7 billion people on this planet, we cannot stumble along without major advances in fundamental physical economic principles, a high-level science driver program. In other words, if you're not with nuclear power fully, if you're not canceling all these crazy green policies and going into new technologies of higher energy flux density, you're not going to solve the problem of this planet, because the already accumulated problems of the planet are so great that if you don't go to a full-scale, global, high-energy flux density policy, you're not going to be able to save the planet. So we're going to have to do that. So we're going to have the highest rate of increase in terms of technology that mankind has ever seen. That's going to be our policy. Now look back at another factor we have to take into account. Some people say, well, in the past we've had ups and downs in the economy before. This is a bad one, admittedly. But we've had ups and downs before. Why can't we just bounce back to a better policy, a better business policy, and leave it at that? Maybe with a little bit of high technology, a little bit more of nuclear power in that. You won't make it. The world won't make it. Now you've got to pay for your fast sins, your indolence. Because unless we can increase the productive powers of labor per capita per square kilometer in a rate beyond anything ever done before, we're not going to make it. We may seem to make it for a short time, but we won't make it. That means that we have to look at what was never done before. We never had in the entire post-war period, from 1945 on, 1946 on, we never had an actual net growth in the productive powers of labor inside the United States itself. Never. We never had a recovery. We had a varying rate of loss of economy, loss of net productivity. Just look at the physical conditions of things. Look at what you had in each town and city in the United States in 1946. Look at the standard of income in physical terms. Look at the quality of education. Look at the question of things like optimism, the increase in power rates and so forth. And then consider the rate of attrition based on any fixed or relatively fixed technological weight. Without a high gain program of a type of dedication we've never had before, we won't make it. We'll make it less bad in the meantime, but the long-term thing is not good. Therefore, we're going to have to go for very high concentration on scientific driver programs, which will give us a rate of increase of the physical productivity per capita per square kilometer needed to meet the demands of a world population now approaching 7 billion people and still growing. To do this job, we have to essentially eliminate the idea of social economic planning based on monetary budgets. We'll still use money, we'll still do it for transactions and so forth, but we won't plan what our policies are, economic policies are, in terms of dollars or other currencies. We will have a fixed exchange rate world financial system, that is a credit system. We'll have that. But we will not calculate on the basis of monetary calculations, because money is not real. Money does not in itself represent the real economy. Money is a guess. It's a useful guess we make, at best. A useful guess as to what we should be doing in using money as an estimate of how it's going to look in planning policy. But what we're going to base policy on are physical economic objectives and physical economic budgeting rather than financial budgeting. We will use financial systems as a way of conducting the implementation in detail of national and world policies. But the policies will not be made on a dollar basis, for example. They'll be made on a physical economic basis, based on physical terms, physical factors of increase of productivity, of labor per capita and per square kilometer. Now, to understand this, we have a branch of science which is most relevant for this purpose. And that branch of science is called physical economy, or otherwise known as physical chemistry. Now, physical chemistry is something which emerged out of the effect of many things coming in, but distinctively as a subject matter, it sort of came along about the time that Mendeleev was developing the periodic table. It came in the form of the development of revolutions in physical economy as such, and involved people like Max Planck. His work involved the work of Einstein at another level. It involved the work of William Draker Harkins. It involved the work of course, Mendeleev himself, Vygotsky, and so forth. So we're going to be thinking in those terms of reference in planning the economy. Now, the way we'll look at this, you look at the way in which the fertility of human populations grow. We're going to think in terms of fertility, in terms of productive potential, physical productive potential. We're going to think of the direct physical factors which determine that potential, such as power, energy flux density, for example. All of these things which are features of modern physical chemistry, that is based, if you eliminate all the Adam Smiths and related stuff from the system. And it's going to be a new kind of economy. And it's a part of the economy which is the one that actually determines what the end result of policy will be. But it has to be expressed for practice, in terms of applications, in terms of physical chemistry, the physical chemistry of mankind's increase of energy flux density, increase of potential relative population density. And this will go as the driver will be the objective of reaching Mars, and that's not so simple as some people think, and developing an industrial base on the moon to enable us to do things such as reaching Mars. So we're going to be thinking in completely new terms. We're going to take the old idea of what's taught as economics. We're going to throw it out the window, except as a museum piece. And we're going to come in with a completely new approach to managing national and world economy. And since most people don't think in terms of the ideas of Vygotsky, for example, they don't know how to organize an economy, really, for success. Some of us either do or are working at becoming capable of doing it. And that this economy, the real physical economy, the one that doesn't show up on the profit and loss statement, that's the real economy. That's the physical economy. And that's where what is now would be considered as the secret economy, the one on which we have to rely to solve these problems, but also one which virtually no economist knows a damn thing about today. Well, that's what I would like to discuss with you.
Years ago, King James VI of Scotland inherited the throne of England at a time when the Christian Church was deeply divided. Here at Hampton Court in 1604, he convened a conference of churchmen of all shades of opinion to discuss the future of Christianity in this country. The king agreed to commission a new translation of the Bible that was acceptable to all parties. This was to become the King James or Authorized Bible, which next year will be exactly four centuries old. Acknowledged as a masterpiece of English prose and the most vivid translation of the scriptures, the glorious language of this Bible has survived the turbulence of history and given many of us the most widely recognized and beautiful descriptions of the birth of Jesus Christ, which we celebrate today.
And so it was that, while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered.
And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night.
And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of heavenly hosts praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill towards men.
Bible was a major cooperative endeavor that required the efforts of dozens of the day's leading scholars. The whole enterprise was guided by an interest in reaching agreement for the wider benefit of the Christian Church and to bring harmony to the kingdoms of England and Scotland. 400 years later, it is as important as ever to build communities and create harmony. And one of the most powerful ways of doing this is through sport and games.
Well played! Go, 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 go!
During this past year of abundant sporting events, I've seen for myself just how important sport is in bringing people together from all backgrounds, from all walks of life, and from all age groups. In the parks of towns and cities and on village greens up and down the country, countless thousands of people every week give up their time to participate in sport and exercise of all sorts, or simply encourage others to do so. These kinds of activity are common throughout the world and play a part in providing a different perspective on life.
Team, go guys, go.
Apart from developing physical fitness, sport and games can also teach vital social skills. None can be enjoyed without abiding by the rules. And no team can hope to succeed without cooperation between the players. This sort of positive team spirit can benefit communities, companies, and enterprises of all kinds. As the success of recent Paralympics bear witness, a love of sport also has the power to help rehabilitate. One only has to think of the injured men and women of the armed forces to see how an interest in games and sport can speed recovery and renew a sense of purpose, enjoyment, and comradeship. Right around the world, people gather to compete under standard rules, and in most cases in a spirit of friendly rivalry. Competitors know that to succeed they must respect their opponents. Very often they like each other too. Sportsmen and women often speak of the enormous pride they have in representing their country, a sense of belonging to a wider family. We see this vividly at the Commonwealth Games, for example, which is known to many as the Friendly Games, and where I'm sure you have noticed that it is always the competitors from the smallest countries who receive the loudest cheers. People are capable of belonging to many communities, including a religious faith. King James may not have anticipated quite how important sport and games were to become in promoting harmony and common interests. But from the scriptures in the Bible which bears his name, we know that nothing is more satisfying than the feeling of belonging to a group who are dedicated to helping each other. Therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. I wish you and all those whom you love and care for a very happy Christmas.
Refused to live in London. She much preferred to stay in one of her country places where she could keep politics at a distance. Here at Osborne, she worked dutifully enough at her desk reading state papers. But if ministers came all the way from London, she might not even see them, just communicate with them via a private secretary. No wonder that when Gladstone was Prime Minister, he called Osborne the great enemy. Her estate, she liked the company of her servants, notably a blunt-speaking man named John Brown. Brown was intensely loyal to the Queen. They became close. The government's problem with Brown was that he supported the Queen's reclusive lifestyle. He was protective of her and tended to be over-familiar with visiting ministers, who didn't take to being slapped on the back and occasionally ordered around. It was an arrangement that continually displeased ministers. Benjamin Disraeli, for one, resented having to trek around the country, attending Victoria wherever she happened to be. Visiting the Queen in those days can't have been a lot of fun. She didn't like heated houses, so most guests were left shivering. And then at mealtimes, she fell ravenously upon her food. And since the rule was that everything was cleared away when the Queen had finished, most guests were left hungry too. Disraeli found Balmoral particularly disagreeable, On his first visit there, he got a stomach upset. On his second, a severe chill. He asked to be excused any further invitations. But Disraeli was the Prime Minister who finally persuaded the Queen to re-enter public life. He had two tricks up his sleeve. One was flattery. When it comes to royalty, he said, you should lay it on with a trowel. And the other was India. Together, his courtly manners and his ambitions for the empire appealed to Victoria, and she happily adopted him as another of her older male advisers. If Albert's death had been the undoing of young Victoria, in her maturity she gained a new lease of life, thanks to India. It was the jewel in her crown. And in 1876, Benjamin Disraeli proposed that she take the title Empress of India. Now, that title was reserved for use with regard to India. But Victoria loved being called Empress so much that she used it whenever she felt like it. Although in her entire reign she never actually visited India, Victoria was fascinated by Indian culture and the affection of the Indian people for her. The Queen began to take Indian servants into her royal household. Perhaps the best known of these is this man, Abdul Karim. He taught her Urdu, and he served as her general advisor on Indian matters. And it's curious that for all the pomp and the circumstance surrounding Victoria's reign, she herself was not too fastidious about social rank. She would happily take a nip of whiskey with John Brown. Abdul Karim was the son of a prison pharmacist, but he was made welcome here at Osborne. As soon as Victoria became Empress of India, her life changed for the better. She attended state balls and she went on tours of the country. She won back the public's affection. By the time of the Golden Jubilee in 1887, she'd become the queen they wanted, a semi-magical figure who symbolized the unity of a great empire. When she drove through the streets of London, huge crowds cheered her on. They seemed to have forgotten all their old resentments. Victoria also became Europe's grandmother. Through her eldest daughter, Vicky, she was now related to Kaiser Wilhelm II, who would go to war with Britain in 1914. And her granddaughter, Alex, married Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, who, along with his family, would be murdered by the Bolsheviks in 1918. In one way or another, she was related to the royal houses of Norway, Sweden, Greece, Romania, Spain, and Mexico. All over Osborne House, there are signs of just how important this family network was to Victoria. She herself had a reputation for being rather a stern mother. She saw herself as responsible for the moral development of her children. But that picture seems to say it all. She carried over the model of family life into her role as queen, where she was the matriarch responsible for the welfare of her subjects, in return expecting their love and respect. By the end, she'd got both. Victoria died at Osborne on Tuesday, the 22nd of January, 1901. She was 81. As she lay dying, her grandson, Kaiser Wilhelm, knelt at her bedside and held her hand. Her long reign had shown that even a determined queen could not stem the tide of parliamentary progress. But it had also shown that monarchy could be important as a symbol of nation and empire, setting the tone for political, social, and family life. The day she died, she was much revered and much missed. As the novelist Henry James said, "We all feel a bit motherless today." Of all England's kings and queens, Elizabeth I is the most famous. She was imperious, cunning, sexy, ruthless, and feminine. She's become the star of movies, books, television. She was, above all, supremely successful. And yet, mysteries remain. How did Elizabeth manage to prevail against such enormous odds in what was a man's world? And why did she never marry? Was it because sexually she was not fully a woman? Or was it rather because to Elizabeth, her virginity was always the key instrument of her power? November 1558, a messenger set out from London for Hatfield House in Hertfordshire. A young woman was waiting anxiously. The messenger carried momentous news. 6 hours earlier, his loyalty was to the Catholic Queen Mary. Now she was dead, and the country was ruled by a Protestant queen, Elizabeth. Elizabeth was the daughter of King Henry VIII by his second wife, Anne Boleyn. Now, Henry's marriage to Anne had been bigamous. He was still in the process of detaching himself from wife number one, Catherine of Aragon. So, strictly speaking, Elizabeth was illegitimate. And, strictly speaking, the illegitimate had no right to succession. The birth of Elizabeth, a girl, had been a dreadful blow to Henry. He felt sure that where his first marriage had failed, Anne would bring him a male heir. When she didn't, he had no use for her. Henry looked for a third wife, and Anne Boleyn had her head chopped off. Elizabeth was only three. She never got to know her mother. She grew up mainly here, at Hatfield House to the north of London, with her own little circle of ladies-in-waiting and tutors. The seeds of independence in her were sown at a very early age. Elizabeth was clever and confident. As a young girl, she became fluent in 5 different languages. She studied history and philosophy. She also loved riding and shooting with a crossbow. By 1537, Henry had fathered 3 children. The first was Mary, Elizabeth's elder half-sister, and the Catholic daughter of Henry's first wife. Mary now came to live with Elizabeth, whom she immediately considered a spoilt Protestant brat, but after a while became fond of her. Then they were joined by their younger brother, Edward, who, like Elizabeth, was Protestant, the son of their father's third wife, Jane Seymour. Together, this odd little group of half-sisters and brother enjoyed all the pleasures of country living. There were gardens for contemplation, there were parks for hunting in, and there were tutors for the advancement of their learning. But Elizabeth must have realized that what united the three of them was their father, still alive. Their mothers were all dead. This seemed like a world in which women were dispensable. Henry VIII had been a distant father and seen little of Elizabeth since her mother's execution. By 1544, he was a man in decline, dealing with the mess of his, by now, 5 disastrous marriages. He began to feel it was time for reconciliation. On June the 26th in 1544, Henry invited all 3 of his children to a grand banquet in Whitehall. followed by a reception at which they were introduced to the court, and he announced the order of succession. First was going to come Edward, his son, then his oldest daughter, Mary, and finally Elizabeth. But with two ahead of her in line for the succession, a princess she might be, but a queen surely never. Henry was at last taking a fatherly interest in Elizabeth, and she responded. Shortly after the banquet, Elizabeth wrote to Henry, hailing him as matchless and most benevolent father. She said she was determined to be not only an imitator of his virtues, but indeed an inheritor of them. She was only 12 years old, but clearly saw herself as a chip off the old block. 3 years later, her father died, and his young Protestant son Edward came to the throne. Elizabeth liked and trusted Edward. She did very well out of his reign, acquiring dozens of large estates, including this one here at Hatfield, her principal residence. But 6 years on, Edward too was dead. The devoutly Catholic Mary came to the throne. For Elizabeth, her sister spelt danger. Mary began fiercely to dismantle the Protestant state and wanted Elizabeth, who was now her successor, to convert to Catholicism. Elizabeth kept making excuses. The relationship between the two sisters became hostile. Then Mary announced her intention of marrying Philip of Spain, a Catholic and a foreigner loathed by England's Protestants. Whether she liked it or not, Elizabeth now became the Protestants' rallying point and a threat to Mary. Insurrection was in the air.
Let our republicanism, so focused and so dedicated, not be made fuzzy and futile by unthinking and stupid labels. Remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Yeah. And just the fact that Schwarzenegger's the governor here, that's so hilarious. It fits if you understand what I'm talking about.
No, it does.
You know, so then after Reagan, that image has collapsed, and then you have this paradigm shift of the New World Order and a global society coming in, even though it's been global for 100 years, but for the population, with the beginning of the computer hookups, so it's an information society. So who do you bring in? The head of the information programmers, the CIA. Just as Gorbachev was the head of the KGB. So then the information society collapses. And everybody is...
Money!
What?
Money!
No, it collapses.
Power, money! That's the next president.
No, the next president is the ultimate... The beginning
of... Oh, yeah, Bill Clinton.
Yeah, the awareness of the Android meme. And that technology is coming alive. And that it's talking back to us. And yet we can interact with it. So you have the age of the Internet. The dot-com boom, or the dot-com 90s. And who's the president? A great communicator, but he's a slippery communicator.
Slick Willie.
Slick Willie. He's a guy that represents the snake-like intertwinedness of digital life. And the other part of him is the guy who claimed he invented the Internet.
Yeah.
And it's really the end of the Internet. But when something's over, everybody's using it. It's obsolete, everybody's using it. So the Internet, the Android meme dies in 1990. It then offers its corpse to everybody. See, that's Gates. And everybody's in it, and the president's Slick Willie. So, then you have Y2K, which sold a lot of computers. Could you be preparing for that? That didn't happen, because there was no Android meme, right? It'd been dead 10 years. So I predicted nothing would happen, nothing happened. So now you're totally in the post-information age. Everybody's sick of the average American, the middle America. They're sick of the media-managed images coming out of L.A. and New York. They don't want any slick guy, Slick Willie or Slick Gore. So Gore hasn't got a chance. And the guy who wins is the guy who just smirks and has nothing to say. Just says, we're still here, and everything's great. Continue shopping. That is the Bush image, all right? In a post-information society, you have a guy who can't communicate. Now, we've come to the end of that, all right? There's a need for a new, well, this new technology, YouTube, affected 2006. Just that one thing on George Allen, that politician, he said some word about Mexicans or something, and he was out, right? And that was symbolic of the power of the YouTube threatening. You say anything, you screw up, we'll put you on YouTube. We're faster than the New York Times. And that is a new factor where people aren't even, they can create their own information fantasy, knowing it's fake, knowing it's a post-information world, but do it anyways, just like swimming and surfing. And we don't care about what anybody else says, and that's the blogosphere also. So what is the presidential image for that? So the Americans are struggling this year with the Obama image, the Hillary image, or the Pentagon McCain image. Now, I want to, if you go on the Internet and look in Harold Channer, Bob Dobbs, you'll see what I said on TV in New York a couple weeks ago. And, on May 22nd, on Thursday. I don't want to say any more about that unless you get some questions.
Who do you think is going to win the election?
No. There's not going to be an election. There never was an election since 1996, okay? There was no election in 2000 because it's a post-information society. Election is an institution of communication from the civic body to the legislative institutions. All those institutions are swallowed up in the death of the Android meme, so there's no communication. So you had an election in 2000 that got canceled and was decided by something called the Supreme Court, and everybody thought that sounded fishy and claimed it was a conspiracy, but it was totally resonant with the fact that it's a post-information society. So there wasn't an election in 2004, and there's not going to be one in 2008. And who's president? The president is who's ever winning in the polls. So right now, McCain's ahead. He's the president. Bush ain't the president anymore. He's not an issue. Who is it of those three candidates? So, in whatever could happen over the next 6 months determines what the polls are going to do. And whoever the polls say it is in November, that'll be it. But that will be changed by March 2009. Whoever is in the polls and is dominating is the president. Because the president is an afterimage in itself. Has no, served no useful function other than reminding Americans and young Americans that there was a country that they could have grown up in, and they can believe that they're still there as long as they can.
Thank you.
and welcome to Studio 13. This is Tom Brennan. Tonight it's my pleasure to bring to you the world's only artist, Bob Dobbs. I think the most impressive achievement of Bob in the last few years has been to subtly show us all that the mind and thinking can be fun. In Western society, we are given probably two thoughts, both of them worries, one to do with death, one to do with money, where is it coming from? We're taught that we can have fun getting on computers and doing nice little graphics or going to play racquetball or kickboxing. Bob shows you that you can use your mind as your own computer base for fun. You can think and rethink and synthesize everything you are being bombarded with into your own recreation. In following with Joyce's axiom that Bob quoted on one of his CDs, all our past times become pastimes. Recreational thinking can be fun. Pleasure to have you on, Bob.
Thanks
for being here, and you're looking great.
Great intro. I mean, that's no one said it that way before. I give you kudos for that. That's original. That's accurate. One of the best summations I've ever heard of what I'm about.
That's great. Thank you. The first question I wanted to go into is, I know you, you're very conversant with Norman Mailer's work. A thought that occurred to me while listening to your tape, and Bob has two CDs out, both are excellent, Bob's Media Ecology and Bob's Media Ecology Squared. I think Mailer's career, you state in 1945, time ended, linear time, with the explosion of the atomic bomb. Mailer had a pop novel, a very pop novel, The Naked and the Dead,
from 48.
Number one bestseller in 48. And then immediately, in his career arc, he goes in the exact opposite direction. He used the success from that to write a virtually unreadable, dense, polemical novel, Barbary Shore, about Trotskyists versus Stalinists, which nobody wanted to read, least of all himself. I think that career arc, though, that tension, setting up a tension with the pop work and then what your next work will be, is something that's become ingrained in artists, even very thoughtless, very artists that generally don't think that much have used that as a career course. You know, you have Dylan going from discovering Rambo can mix with Chuck Berry and then turning around and doing the Jesus thing. So it's been something that American artists have followed really well. How does that fit into the Bobscape?
Where are the charts?
Where are the charts?
Are they hidden in here somewhere? Where are the charts?
I do have one in the folder over there.
All right.
I do have one in some folders.
Yeah, what's very important is I have, you asked me, what has it got to do? The charts express this thing, and it's very important. It's a dialectic between Norman Mailer and Marshall McLuhan. Is that Mailer, his whole dilemma was to act out the problem you just expressed for the role of the traditional artist or writer in a world where culture becomes our business.
Mm-hmm.
And so he acted out the effects and therefore was very violent, because he didn't have the technique of suspended judgment. Marshall had the technique of suspended judgment, and he explained the causes of the dilemma for Norman Mailer. And there's a documentary on Marshall made by his daughter, Stephanie, about 1984, where they have Trudeau, several news people, and they have Norman on. And Norman says that up to the point he met Marshall, he thought he had the fastest brain in the West, that he was the smartest person. But when he met Marshall, he said, no, this guy goes a lot faster than me. That's the point. You've got to be fast to understand the electric environment, to then perceive what Finnegan's Wake is doing. And no novelist in our time has ever expressed a new form of novel that included Finnegan's Wake, because Finnegan's Wake killed the novel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ulysses did. Finnegan's Wake then solved the problem of what a book would do after the death of the novel. Now, Marshall knew that, and therefore he wrote the greatest science fiction novel of our time,
which is
all his work in science fiction novel, but this is spelled in, if you read his letters, it's about page 217, a letter he wrote to his mother, and he said, I've discovered a new form of science fiction novel, and I'm not out to prove anything, but to show the community in action. He says, it is a new kind of novel. So Marshall McLuhan, unbeknownst to Reverend Stang and the rest of the gang here living in America, don't know that Marshall was a novelist, and he outdid Norman Mailer. And he did not have that dilemma, even though Marshall was involved in a subtle way with the assassination of President Kennedy. If you read his foreword to The Interior Landscape, he says, "Must we continue to mow down the Kennedys?" Blah, 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 blah. You know, we, he includes himself.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Mailer never thought that he was responsible for killing Kennedy. And therefore,
he did express guilt in Mike and the Siege of Chicago about the Robert Kennedy assassination.
He did not know why.
Because I had fornicated with a witch the night of the deed.
Yeah, very good.
And he thought that was a causal factor, that his lack of faith in his own marriage contributed subtly to the negativism of the Year of the Monkey, 68.
Very good.
And Robert's demise.
That's the, you know, but he's acting.
But he was using it as a novelist, an American actor, method actor kind of interpretation, don't you think?
Yeah, he's William Irwin Thompson, in simple terms, expresses the Norman's problem. He was still acting out the Western Prometheus ego.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't know how to create an ego without it, to quote Beefheart, without it flying, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Marshall knew how to create an ego without it flying in your face. And maybe that is the difference between Canada and America. You know, that could be the dilemma and the dialectic acted out by Marshall and Norman Mailer.
Very interesting. So in a sense, Marshall's work itself was the hero.
Yes.
The fictive that he created was the hero, whereas Mailer always wanted to inject himself as the persona that was undergoing these...
He was the user.
Based on classic like James Fenimore Cooper,
yes,
Mark Twain, you know, you always have to be the American protagonist on the road, so your ego is confronting everything and chopping it down.
Yes, the Canadian never...
Whereas Marshall was at a remove.
He never had a national identity, so he could put it on.
And more playful.
Yes.
Playfulness is
because
he
never had a national identity. I was born in Paris in 1922. I wasn't a Canadian. I wasn't born in Canada.
You were born on the same day as James Joyce.
Yes, the day that, not the same day. Yes, the same day. And I think of it more as the day the book came out, February 2nd, mm-hmm. 1922, when Ulysses came out. And my work, I mean, I knew both Mailer and McLuhan in the early years, in the early 50s, and that's why I had him.
Who was more fun to hang with on a personal level?
No, Mailer. Marshall was very impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that
I told him not to publish the Deer Park.
Who told him not to?
Did you?
No, I wasn't part
supportive
of
all his
I was feeding him.
Ambitions.
See, you know, Harless Ghost is about Connie and me.
Right. And Connie is Kittredge, and you are you?
I'm Harry.
Harry.
And I fed him a lot of the information, and I was the person he interviewed to get his material to understand what it was like in the CIA. And it's actually about life in the DIA and involved with the Secret Council of 10. But Mailer, he's a populist, so he's going to talk on the level that the people can
mm-hmm.
understand, the institutions they're afraid of or involved with, and that's the CIA. And it's very well done how he shows the dilemma of Hugh.
Mm-hmm.
And Hugh was the person I worked with for many years and then took over. So I'm really interested in how Norm's going to show the transformation of me, Harry, in relation to Hugh in the
next
part two.
Right.
And but I wasn't involved in the his career as a novelist. I was the one who fed him experiences that he used as a metaphor. You know, I'm the one who told him behind the scenes.
Were you involved in the tunnel experiment?
Yes.
Into East Berlin when you were tapping.
Yes. I was exactly, approximately that age.
Mm-hmm.
Harry. When is Harry born? He's like 15, about, he's born in 1932, right?
He's rock climbing in 1939, right?
Yeah.
That's his test of manhood. He's rock climbing, so he's about 17 then.
Yeah. Yeah, so he's born about 1930, 32. So that's just 10 years for me. So that's approximately my experience as a young person in the intelligence agencies. But I just want to point out what we have in the chart here. In the period from 1960 to 1977,
mm-hmm.
the computer is the ground, the popular art form in the black and white TV phase is the Beatles, and in the color TV phase, psychedelia is the popular art form. Now, the highbrow art form for that is Norman Mailer's black and white TV
mm-hmm.
phase, and Marshall McLuhan comes in the psychedelic phase.
Massachusetts, small the state of New York by saying that the people of those states will declare our helpless impotency as a nation to attend to our own business. It is the issue of 1776 over again. Our ancestors, well, but 3 million, had the courage to declare their political independence of every other nation upon earth. Now we, their descendants, when we have grown to 70 million, declare that we are less independent than our forefathers? No, my friend, it will never be the judgment of this people.
You know, the New York Times did a series of stories about AIG and Goldman. They never talk about how much AIG bailed out the European banks.
Right.
This is a uniquely focused on what the New York Times reported. All these guys want to score points. Tim Geithner is doing a good job. Again, is that terrible to say? Can't we just come out here occasionally? Can't I, as a commentator, and say, you know what? I'm impressed by what Geithner did.
But get a bodyguard.
I already have one. And I feel strongly that Geithner, this is AIG, AIG, Goldman, Goldman. And you know what? The Bavarian Illuminati, the Trilateral Commission, Goldman Sachs, and the Queen of England are not all bad.
Planet has now entered what is called by scientists and others the Rim of Fire. The Rim of Fire can be located as starting in the South Island of New Zealand, going up through Indonesia, through Japan, to Alaska, coming down to California, and going down to Chile. And it touches a few other areas, but this is it. It's primarily the Pacific Basin, which is a rim of fire. And no nuclear explosion organized by man could ever even approximate the power of this rim of fire. The sun has recently gone into a new phase. a kind of phase has gone into repeatedly in times past, a period of extreme violence, which used to come with an 11-year cycle, is now apparently coming with a 13-year cycle. What happened in Japan is simply a part of an ongoing process which is generated by nothing but the sun itself, the effect of the sun. Now, in order to deal with this crisis, which having hit the South Island of New Zealand, coming to Japan, headed in the direction of Alaska, headed in the direction of California, and down again toward Chile. This thing is something we're going to have to learn how to deal with. It's not a nuclear explosion. Nuclear explosions have nothing to do with this. It's a rim of fire, well known to all specialists in this area, on this subject. Now, what we can do about this will be presented to you in some detail in the following part of this report, which indicates to you what some of the problems are that we have to understand. Problems about what does the sun have to do with this? How do we know this? What do we know about it? What don't we know about it? What are we going to do about it? This indicates that we're going through a period, probably through this year into the year 2013, which will probably be a period of greatest risk for various parts, especially parts of the rim of the Pacific, the rim of fire. And so the report that's about to be given to you now, following my remarks here, will make the matter clear to you.
On the same day of the earthquake, there were auroras. The northern lights, people reported from Canada down as far south as Madison, Wisconsin, reported seeing these brilliant light shows in the nighttime skies. Now, was this just a coincidence that this occurred on the same day as the earthquake, or is there some type of correlation scientifically?
Well, it's very interesting. It was a phenomenal display of the aurora borealis. But to say that the earthquake caused the aurora or that the aurora caused the earthquake would be a mischaracterization. The aurora itself was apparently generated by what's called a coronal mass ejection from the sun, which impacted the Earth's magnetic field on Thursday afternoon. The coronal mass ejection was generated by a series of solar flares that occurred earlier in the week, Monday through Wednesday, which occurred in the context of the sun increasing in its solar activity after a several-year hiatus period. Now, the issue is that, yeah, the auroras were generated by the radiation from the sun. But if we look back at the past several earthquakes, you do see a correlation between solar activity and tectonic activity. For example, the recent earthquake that happened in New Zealand on February 22nd happened a little over a week after this whopper of a solar flare, which is the largest solar flare in 4 years. The Haiti earthquake, which happened last January 2010, occurred 2 or 3 days before a series of very powerful solar flares. So it's interesting that the coincidence and timing of the solar activity is so close in time with the tectonic activity, but you can't say that there's a causal relationship between them. So the question is, what is the relationship?
Just to clarify, has there been a change recently in these types of activities of the sun? I mean, you're saying that the aurora indicates some type of heightened activity on the sun. Is this, how frequent of an occurrence is this? Is this something that happens all the time, or has there been an increase?
Yeah, we're coming right out of the solar minimum, which is typically an 11-year cycle, that every 11 years it goes through a minimum and then a maximum. This particular cycle has been about 13 years, which has some interesting implications in terms of global climate. But usually it's an 11-year cycle, So you could look back and say, well, is there a correlation between increases of solar activity and increases of tectonic activity, such as the earthquakes, but also volcanism?
What is that cycle, actually? What do you mean by the solar cycle itself?
Within the 11-year cycle, you see a decrease in the number of sunspots on the surface of the sun. And Herschel, back in the 1800s, recognized this, that the sunspots become more and more dense and then dwindle to nothing, and then get more and more dense and dwindle to nothing on a cycle of 11 years. It's actually a 22-year-long cycle, but it appears as an 11-year cycle because it goes from one pole to the other. But this is when you have more sunspots, this represents the fact that the magnetic field of the sun, which is also known as the interplanetary magnetic field, because this thing goes all the way out past Jupiter and Saturn, these are periods that the magnetic field of the sun gets much more intense and much more active, which is what's represented by these by the sunspots. And the solar flares actually follow the path of the magnetic field off the sun. So these are periods of higher heightened magnetic phenomena on the sun.
Could you say something about the relationship between the sun and the Earth? What is actually going on in that space? Because I think most people just have the concept of the sun providing warmth, providing light to the Earth, but don't have much of an idea of what is that space between the Earth and the sun.
Yeah, the big problem is that people consider that the solar system as a whole is really just, you know, nine objects floating around in empty space plus this big sun, and we're kind of defending ourselves in this little corner of the solar system all by our lonesome, when in fact, if you go back to the works of Kepler, even he recognized this, that we're dealing with a unified whole system, that there are not individual separate objects in the solar system, but that there's a solar system, and the activity of that system is as a whole system. So in that sense, you have to be interested and intrigued by the correlation between the increased solar activity and then the increased geophysical activity. Because if you look right now, you had the earthquakes in the past 2 years, which are some giant earthquakes and had various effects. At the same time, just recently, within the past week, we've had explosions of many of the volcanoes around the so-called Ring of Fire, the Pacific Ocean rim. So you have an increase in geophysical activity at the same time that you have an increase of solar activity. It'd be a fallacy to say that the sun, that these solar flares are like shooting at the Earth and creating these explosions on the Earth. It would be more accurate to say, and this is something that we have to follow up on in terms of actual experiments and investigation, it becomes more clear that the solar system as a whole is right now going into a more active period, which is represented by these outbursts from at least two known bodies in the solar system. And I would say that we should look for more outbursts like this.
Yeah, I think the tendency would be to say, well, are the flares causing the earthquakes, or are the earthquakes causing the flares, when that's really not the right question, because you're looking at a highly dynamic system from what you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's potentially a higher cause, but it seems like we're seeing some type of correlation between the two. So then how do we approach figuring out what is that higher cause?
Well, the first thing is to look at what happens on the Earth. You have to be a little bit more broad than looking at earthquakes and volcanoes as just pieces of rock moving around on the Earth. That is just static things that are, you know, periodically shifting and moving. You have to look in the domain of what we call cosmic radiation. So, for example, earthquakes, there's a phenomenon of eyewitness accounts of various kinds of strange lights that happen around the epicenters of earthquakes. Many people have described seeing strange lights. For example, in the Chilean earthquake back in 2008, there was a show of lights around the area in Chile where you had the earthquake, and some people claim to have actually filmed it.
You're saying they see lights during the earthquake?
Or? Almost like there's lightning or something like that in the distance.
Hmm.
And some investigators have actually surveyed people around the world who have been near earthquakes to make clear that these people aren't just seeing things, but this is a widespread phenomenon. Earthquake lights, something that's also reported very often, are strange, erratic behavior of animals, like dogs and cats, for example. They have a legendary ability to forecast an earthquake before it happens. Snakes will take off in the area. Rats will flee an area. Other phenomena like strange weather patterns right before an earthquake. These are all eyewitness accounts, and we've been having these eyewitness accounts going back for hundreds of years. Now, there are other, there have been attempts to explain this stuff. You know, the usual attempt is that people are just crazy, which is not true. But other attempts have been to say, well, maybe there is some kind of electromagnetic phenomena happening that the animals can sense and that people can see sometimes.
It's not just a mass hallucination in different parts of the planet at different times.
Right, like right now there's a mass hallucination that there's no such thing as a British Empire, right? But no, it's not a mass hallucination. There is some kind of a real effect going on. So the question is it an electromagnetic effect? Because then you would have a connection between the sun and the earth through the fact that we are living in a cosmic radiative environment. So some of the other effects that have been recognized is, for example, there are magnetometers near the time of an earthquake, before the earthquake, can register strong changes in the geomagnetic field. These are called very long frequency or ultra long frequency oscillations, which are very high amplitude. They're very strong oscillations, but it's about 5 to 10 cycles per second changes in the geomagnetic field. And for example, the whopper that hit Alaska in 1964, which was magnitude 9.2.
Are you talking about a cycle of a change in the magnetic field, or anomalies and irregularities from what is known as the regular shape of the magnetic field?
Well, the geomagnetic field already has secular variations, which are determined by some phenomena inside the Earth, but also determined by activity of the sun, for example. Our magnetic field is very closely connected with the interplanetary magnetic field. But what these guys are measuring, for example, this 1964 Alaska earthquake, there was a magnetometer which happened to be very nearby and also at a high level so that it wasn't damaged in the earthquake, measured, it was between 5 and 10 hertz cycle of change of intensity and direction of the earthquake, or of the geomagnetic field, about 2 hours before the earthquake actually hit.
So an actual change in the Earth's magnetic field preceded the earthquake?
The magnetic field of the Earth, the local magnetic field of the Earth, changes in response to an earthquake before the earthquake actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that a magnetic field is going to shift the rocks on the Earth is kind of a strange idea, but the fact is that the rocks do shift coincident with some kind of a discharge of electromagnetic radiation, which changes the magnetic field. It can be picked up by weather satellites as increased infrared radiation before and after the earthquake. It can also be picked up by some of these global positioning satellites which have to essentially shoot signals back and forth through the ionosphere, which is a charged layer of the atmosphere. And they pick up that up to six days before an earthquake, you have a change in the ionosphere above the area that the earthquake is going to hit. And then that change diminishes after the earthquake over a period of several days. So you do have a coincidence of electromagnetic phenomena and tectonic phenomena. So the cause is not clear yet. That's one of the questions that we need to look towards answering. But the relationship is definitely there.
Now, in recent videos, some members of the basement team have been discussing the 62 million year cycle of the solar system through the galaxy, and the different effects that this has for us on Earth, changes in influx of cosmic radiation, in the in biodiversity, etc. Does this come into our equation here?
We're going to be releasing some more material on this over the coming days as we investigate it. But yes, there is some clear relationship. You have the 60 to 62 million year cycle of biodiversity, which you mentioned. Some of the researchers who identified the 62 million year cycle threw open a net to say, okay, what other cycles on the Earth do we know of that follow a roughly 60 to 62 million year cycle? One of them was the tectonic changes on the Earth. And we've seen that in the great so-called mass extinctions, like the extinction of the dinosaurs or the Permian-Triassic extinction, that those extinctions are associated with increased volcanism and other increased tectonic activity. In fact, the Permian-Triassic extinction is actually, which was like the big mother of all extinctions, like 98% of the species went extinct, is today blamed predominantly on an explosion of volcanism on the surface of the Earth. So there is a 62 million year cycle of this tectonic activity. Now, what we're interested in is the fact that the anti-entropic development of life on the Earth, which goes through these so-called mass extinctions in the form of transformation of the organisms into higher and higher types of organisms, and the transformation of the whole biosphere in these shifts, that must be due to a change in the cosmic radiation environment of the whole solar system. So therefore, a link, a current link, that were we to be able to find a link between increased cosmic radiation in the form of the sun's activity and increase in tectonic activity on the Earth, then we have an experimental domain to work with while observing the fact that you have increase of tectonic activity and rapid transformations of organisms, periods of transformation of organisms on the Earth, which is periodic. And the other interesting thing is that the 62 million year cycle is not a solar system cycle, but it's actually a cycle of our travel through the galaxy. So this is a galactic transformation period.
Well, it really seems like there's a lot of implications for what you just got through. A lot of what we witness on Earth every day is the result of a higher process, but then also it seems that there's a real coherence between these developmental processes, the development of organisms, and in these tectonic shifts that are an effect of a higher process. I'd like to ask you what we should do with this. I mean, where do we go from here? What do we need, given the current economic and political situation that we're in? Where do we go with this?
Well, over the next couple of days, we're going to be pulling together a more detailed picture of the implications. But for now, it's pretty clear that step one, besides dealing with the immediate damage of in Japan and the surrounding areas due to the earthquake and then the gigantic tsunami, we need to get rid of President Obama. That would be the best first step. And then we could put through the Glass-Steagall and the other types of economic changes so that we can start putting back together our human spaceflight program. We need to do things like NOAA and rebuild the system of human control over the biosphere. But along with that, we need to, again, rev up our acceleration of human beings into space. Because, for example, we need to see what types of seismic activity happens on the moon. We need to see what kinds of seismic activity happens on Mars. We don't know. Perhaps Mars is having earthquakes right now, too, that are huge, that we can't measure
Do we measure seismic activity on any other body besides the Earth?
Well, the Apollo astronauts put seismographs down onto the surface of the moon, but those were shut off pretty soon after the Apollo program was ended. So we used to, but now we're confined to the surface of the Earth. But we need to see, is this a solar system-wide phenomenon? And the only way we're going to do that is by getting out into space with people who can do the exploration and put the types of devices out there that we need.
Right, because if we're not measuring the possibility that this could be an effect on the level of the solar system, then it's going to be very difficult to determine that higher cause.
Exactly. If we stay on Earth, we're pretty much screwed. We got to bring people and cats and dogs to the moon and to Mars to see if they respond at the same time to heightened solar activity the way they do on the Earth.
We've come to a time that science must advance itself to the point that we understand better how to deal with some of the peculiarities of our galaxy. Because our solar system, of which the sun is the center, is merely a part of our galaxy, an integral part. The galaxy is not something distant from us. We are in the galaxy. We're on the rim of the galaxy. That's where the solar system is. And often in the past, like the extinction of whole species some time ago, entire species were wiped out and new species emerged of living species on this planet. It was caused by a temper tantrum of sorts, you might call it, by the galaxy. And these are the kinds of things we have to finally come to understand. How does our galaxy work? How does our solar system work? And what are we going to do about getting out there with space exploration by man to find out what really goes on the moon, to find out some of the other things that determine what is going to happen to us on Earth? We have to get out there and find out what it is. And exploring the solar system is one step, but understanding the galaxy is absolutely indispensable.
Well, Early, I'm sure glad Rusty found him some playmates there, dangerously older than him.
Oh, ain't nothing gonna happen. He ain't very sexy with that damn acne. Ain't nobody gonna get in line for a piece of that.
Ain't it odd that a house of God looks like a facade for training their squad and claiming jihad? We're just saying, ain't it odd?
You know, these singing birds have got kind of a point there.
Yep. Only two sources I trust, Glenn Beck and Singing Woodland Creatures. Listen to the animals for a better understanding.
The Holocaust was fake, or was the moon landing?
Now what about Obama and his birth certificate? He was born in Hawaii, that ain't no goddamn state.
He was born in Hawaii, that ain't no goddamn state.
Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill JFK.
Shoot you up with AIDS.
Make big money go. Buy this much guns. Build a motorbike car. Find where the revenues come.
Early.
I was no one there. Rest in city hall. Be your man in a bedroom. You're going to educate them all.
Early. I was
wouldn't trust any of these animals, to tell you the truth.
No problem, no problem.
Remember back when Florida had all them pain chairs? Should have been damn recount.
What? Well, Gore won the popular vote, and he should have had a recount, I think.
Talking animals, that don't make no damn sense.
Well, we're moving on now.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful day in the neighborhood. We hope you all enjoyed thoroughly this little engagement of the third session of Moi. Hope you have a great night and see you soon, if not before. Good day.
Hello, Legions of Anonymous. We are the Church of the Subgenius. Over the years, we have been watching you. We were there when you were born amid the festering pits of 4chan, a bomb's world, and something awful. We were there when you took down Hal Turner. We were there when you became a force to be reckoned with. We were there when you declared war on the Church of Scientology. With the introduction and acceptance of Anonymous into the mainstream media, your actions to expose the world to abnormality, anti-censorship, individuality, rebellion, dissent, and outright pornography have come to our attention. The Church of the Subgenius has therefore decided to issue the following invitation to Anonymous. FFA is coming. The Church of the Subgenius extends an invitation for Anonymous to gather with us this coming July in New York to await the rupture. The arrival at 7 a.m., July 5th, of the escape vessels of the alien sex goddesses, and the final fulfillment of the prophecy of our founder and leader, J. Carl von Dobbs. Next day is an opportunity for members of Anonymous to gather under the auspices of the Church of the Subgenius, pay for their Subgenius ordainments, and thereby benefit from our guarantee of eternal salvation or triple your money back. It is worth noting that the annual XB celebration is a wild, adults-only outdoor rock and roll party that makes the 4chan party van seem like child's play in comparison. It is also worth noting that many Subgenii are already among the ranks of Anonymous. When Anonymous was out in the streets on February 10th and March 15th, we were there among you. Anonymous is invited to attend X-Day in order to gather and take a breather from the Scientology wars into Anonymous Nation. Attendees at X-Day are encouraged to remain anonymous, not to reveal their human names, and to disguise their identities. Random behavior is encouraged as long as participants don't sully the slack of other celebrants attending the festival. Because Scientology will undoubtedly make note of this message, we realize there will be attempts by RTC and OSA to infiltrate X-Day in order to dig up dirt on Anonymous. We are prepared for this, and we encourage Anonymous to participate in several spots of hidden Scientologist events that will be planned for the festival. Please note that live human bonfires are forbidden until after the X is to arrive. When God's prophecy is fulfilled and the true Sub-Genii depart this world on the escape vessels, the chosen legions of Anonymous, or at least the ones who join us on our holy pilgrimage, shall be there with us. But until then, we offer you Slack. We offer you support. And we offer you the opportunity to gather and party with your fellow Anons in a place far away from so-called civilization dominated by the conspiracy of the normals. We are the Church of the Sub-Genius. We are among you. We are unexpected. But MFB can't take a joke. Praise God.